for refuge in time and money, to the Buddhas, the Dharma, and the assembly of saints.
From the virtuous merits that I collect, by the practice of giving and other actions,
may I attain the state of the Buddha, to the death of all sentient beings.
For refuge in time and money,
to the Buddhas, the Dharma, and the assembly of saints. From the virtuous merits that I collect, by the practice of giving and other actions, may I attain the state of the Buddha, to the death of all sentient beings.
May all beings have happiness and the causes of happiness. May all beings be free from suffering and the causes of suffering.
May all beings never be separated from the bliss of source.
May all be from aversion and clean. And as it's covered with flowers, sprinkled with scented water, in the middle of this mountain river, surrounded by four continents and
ornamented by the sun and the moon.
May all sentient beings partake of the Buddha's realms. Om Guru Buddha Bodhisattva Sapparivara Radha Mandala Buddha Megha Samudha Varana Samaya. So welcome everybody. So before we go on to a new chapter, the chapter on refuge, I just wanted to tie up a couple of loose ends from last time. One was, we made reference to a teaching that our founder Geshe Thachi Namgyel made a long time ago, and some of you have heard or are familiar with, which is the avoiding the faults of the listener in a Dharma teaching, and it's using cups as an example. So I thought, just for the benefit of the people that maybe haven't heard the whole thing, it's very short. I would just go through it so that we can all have the same reference when we talk about the cups. So, I don't have a cup, but anyway, the first example is the cup that's turned upside down. So, in other words, nothing's going in when you're listening to the teaching for various reasons. Maybe you're distracted, maybe you're tired, maybe you're bored, whatever. But if the cup is upside down, it's not much use for drinking tea, so we don't want to be a cup turned upside down. And then another cup is the cup that looks nice but has a crack in it, and you pour the tea in it and the tea runs out. So we don't want to be a listener who listens and then forgets everything and goes home and goes, what was that again? So we want to try to retain the teaching so that we are a good receptacle for tea. And then the third cup is the cup that has poison in it. It looks nice, but when you pour the tea in it and you drink it, it makes you sick. So what do you think the poison might be? Anybody suggest?
Huh?
Anger. Anger, yeah. What else?
Mm-hmm. Hmm? Wrong view.
Wrong views, like what?
Greed. Misunderstanding of emptiness.
Yeah, okay.
Nihilism.
Nihilism.
Thinking the self is independent.
Uh-huh.
Ignorance, right?
Yeah, versions of ignorance, yeah. Or, I don't believe in karma. That's New Age. You know, if you don't believe in karma, it's hard to be a Buddhist. So to not have these poisons, one teacher one time said it could be something like, well, that teacher doesn't know very much, or I know more than that guy, or I'm not sure I believe that teacher. That's another kind of version of being
pride,
being poisoned.
Mm-hmm. Pride.
Pride, yeah.
Arrogance.
Arrogance, yeah, yeah. So don't be a cup with poison. Be a good cup. Okay, so that's the three cups teaching, being a good listener. So that was one thing I wanted to mention for people that hadn't heard the whole story. And then another thing I'd like to just touch on, not too long, but just before we go on, is something that I had referenced, which is this idea of using the text as a meditation manual with the format of listening, contemplation, and meditation. But then somebody said, well, how do you do that? So I thought what I'd do,
it's just kind of run through a sort of like a role play of what it might look like, because there's lots of different ways of doing that, but just to give people an idea of how it might be done. So taking the last lesson as an example, faith was the last lesson, right? The last chapter. So when we come here, we do the listening part, and then when you go home, you asked what was the homework, right? Do you remember asking that question? You know, the homework. So if you want to really, you know, get a lot out of this text, and it's a very special text, and you want to use this format, what you could do is you could go home and do the contemplation part next. And does anybody remember what we said the contemplation was? Or what do we mean when we say contemplation in this context? Stephen?
Well, I don't remember what you said.
No, what you said last time, remember?
Oh.
Analysis, right? Remember?
Well, yeah.
So you analyze the text. Now, when you're doing the contemplation, it's open book. So you can look at the book, you can look at your notes. And we said you want to know what the teaching was, but also, you remember?
How to use it.
What the teaching
is not.
Wasn't.
Right.
Right? So you want to be clear. Maybe you have a question, you might want to go back and ask the question to clarify so that we're really sure about what it is that the teaching was and what it wasn't, which sometimes is even more important because we have all these ideas that aren't necessarily the right idea. So you can go through that process and get yourself really clear. Okay? And then the third step is meditation. So I just want to kind of run through like a role play of what it might sound like. And this is just an example. There's other ways you can do it. But if we go back to the lesson on faith, does anybody remember what His Holiness Sakya Trichin said? I made a one-line quote to summarize it. Does anybody remember that?
Faith is everything.
Hey, faith is everything. Mm-hmm. So that's kind of the headline. Meaning, this is an important topic. And remember we talked about it's important if you're going to build a tall building to have a good foundation. Yeah, and we talked about Drakpa Gyantse kind of simplified it, the foundation for us to down to two topics. So faith is one of them.
Refuge
was the other one. So that means faith is really important that we get this right if we're going to, you know, build our tall building of our spiritual practice. So then the question arises, well, what is faith? And then we talked about, remember we talked about the suitcase?
Yeah.
You remember?
Yeah.
What did we say?
There's four different thieves in Italy and those metaphors.
But before the thieves, what did we say? What was written on the side of the suitcase, Vasubandhu's suitcase? It said faith, and then on the name tag it said there are
two kinds of faith. Three kinds.
Three kinds of faith. And if you don't remember, you can look at your notes, right, when you're doing the contemplation. Does anybody remember the three kinds? Or anybody remember one of the three kinds?
Clear-minded.
Aspiration.
She's on a roll.
Truth of the Three Jewels.
That was a subtopic.
Laws of Karma.
Yeah, that was a subtopic.
You said confident.
Confident faith. Yeah, confident, aspiration, and clear. CAC. If that helps you. Yeah. Okay. So this is the cup that's not got a crack, it's remembering everything, right? So you go through that review in your mind in the contemplation. And then, Nicole, what do we have to watch out for?
The thieves.
How many are there?
I thought there was four, yeah.
Yeah, okay. Anybody remember the thieves?
Yeah.
What are they? Okay. What are they?
It's just a good metaphor. It was just one that had, like, the ice cream. But hold on, so I have to, it's a metaphor that like helps me figure this out, I think.
Yeah.
So the ice cream related, can I just say the story? Or
yeah, yeah, say the story, say the story.
I don't even know. What if I don't remember? Now I'm embarrassed. Never mind. Let somebody else go.
Okay, and I gave you a little memory trick. I said, well, there's four of them, but if you take one of them out, do you remember that?
Oh, fear. So
if you take fear out, so fear is one of them. You take that out, what are you left with?
Anger.
The?
Point.
Three?
Poisons.
Poisons. The three poisons, which are?
Anger, ignorance, desire, and anger.
Yeah, okay. So that's another little memory trick. You've got fear, you take the fear out, you're left with the three poisons, and then you have the four thieves, right? That you have to guard against the four thieves. So we get the faith, we get what it is, we guard against the thieves, we don't lose it. And then what do? What's the next step?
We go refuge?
Make it?
Grow it?
Grow.
Wow.
Yeah, do you remember that? How do we do that?
By practicing.
Practicing what? Scrabble?
Dharma.
Dharma, like what?
Well, but don't practice anything.
Yeah?
That's a good question.
What you heard of the Dharma?
Huh?
That's a good question, Link.
It's a good question. So if we don't know, what do? We go back to the book and say, well, what did the book say? How do you make it grow? Oh, I don't know. What page was that on? Oh, ignorance. Okay. So, reading biographies, stories of saints, makes it grow, doesn't it?
Yeah.
Devotion, remember we talked about devotion, meditation.
An auspicious site.
Sorry?
An auspicious site.
Auspicious site?
To practice.
That's the next step. You're jumping ahead.
I'm jumping ahead. Okay.
You're sharp, but that's too soon. Okay, so we want to make our faith grow with these different practices. Devotion to the lineage. Remember the preceptors in the lineage. Reading those biographies. Those are all ways that make your faith grow. If you read about Virupa and the Sakya masters and these saints that lived centuries and centuries, it's pretty inspiring what these people have done, really. I mean, I'm sure all of you have read biographies. So that all of those make your faith grow more. And then what do? You just said it.
Have an auspicious site to practice.
Yeah, you're going to practice because the medicine's no good on the shelf, right? You got to take it down, and consume it, take it. And it helps to have a place. And we used an example or a metaphor about a place, creating a meditator's... I know Karen knows this because it came from IBA, the little booklet. Meditator's nest. What is the feeling of a nest? It's like home, safe.
It's cozy.
Yeah, so you create some kind of physical space with whatever circumstances you have. And then you've identified the faith. You've warded off the enemies. You've made it grow. You created your nest. And then what do? You practice. You practice, yeah. Okay. So this is kind of what the book led us through in the chapter, right? And if you don't remember, that's okay. You go back and look at it, you know. But then you patch the crack in your cup so you remember. Otherwise, why bother, you know, if you're not going to practice? Otherwise, it just becomes another nice book you put back on the shelf, you know. So you go through that process and analyze, okay, it's not blind faith. We said that last time. It's not blind faith. It's informed logical faith. And it has, you know, all these aspects that we just went through. And then what do? You make sort of a summary of what we just said, because that's kind of a long speech that we just went through, but you want to summarize it. So you could say faith is important. It's logical. It's inspirational. We need to protect it. We need to grow it. And we need to create the conditions to practice. That's kind of a summary of what we just said. Yeah. So that's the second step of analysis or contemplation. And then what's the third step? Listening, contemplation, Meditation. So what do we meditate on? So Geshe Tashi Namgyo said that meditation was one pointed concentration on a wholesome object. That's kind of a summary. So what's the wholesome object here in this meditation that we're going to do?
Faith.
Sorry?
The faith.
It's the summary.
The summary
is going to be the object.
That's so many objects.
Hmm?
There's like a lot within that.
There's four. One, two, three, four, five. So that's your object. You're going to boil it down. This is just an example, okay? You're going to boil it down to something. It can't be pages and pages. That's too much. Mm-hmm. So you boil it down to something that's manageable. And if five is too many, take three. And if three is too many, take one. You want to have your meditation short and quality, not long and iffy. Mm-hmm. Right? Mm-hmm. So you're going to adapt it to yourself. Because your practice is not the same as hers or mine or yours. Everybody's got their own practice. You want to tailor it to yourself so you get something out of it. So at the end of the day, you had some benefit, right? So you summarize it and make a wholesome object. And then you meditate on that so that it goes in deep. That's the whole idea, right? It goes in deep. Otherwise, it's just kind of up here intellectual stuff with a lot of words. Because we want to have something that lasts, you know, that carries us. It's a strong foundation for this high rise of enlightenment that we're building. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Okay. So that's just one way you could do it. You could do it lots of other ways, but just to give you another example, you could take the three kinds of faith, which are.
Clear-minded.
Aspirational and confident.
So you could take that as your object of meditation, and you could focus on that so that that goes in deep. Okay, now I got that. And then maybe tomorrow you take another piece. I mean, you tailor it to your needs, you know, so that you're getting something out of it. Otherwise, you could be watching Netflix. Does that make any sense? Does that give you an idea at least of this format if you want to use this text as a meditation manual? Mm-hmm. And you adapt it to yourself and get creative. I'm just giving you some ideas about how it could be done.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Comments, questions, or complaints?
My brain is too thick.
Your brain is thick.
Is there a thick cup?
It's Tibetan tea.
I don't know. This is not my tradition.
Okay. So that's sort of tying a few loose ends from last time. Before moving on to page 9, the chapter on refuge. Now, we say the refuge prayer every time, every practice. So now we're going to find out, well, what is refuge? What are the different kinds of refuge, and why do we do it? So I've already talked too much, so I'm going to ask a volunteer to read the first paragraph for us on page 9, the chapter on refuge.
I'll volunteer.
Okay.
The meditation to be practiced is said to consist of the preparation through seeking refuge and offering prayers. The main meditation on one's chosen object and the contemplation through sharing
completion through sharing
merit and recollection. According to this arrangement, the preparation and completion should be added at the beginning and the end of all the sessions of meditation described in this book. Though refuge is usually considered to be the preparation, here, at the time of explaining refuge itself, it will be treated as the main meditation and a detailed description of its parts will be given. Refuge is said to consist of five topics: A. Cause, B. Object, C. Procedure, D. Benefit, E. Precepts.
Okay, thank you. Just to kind of summarize that, just so that it's clear, normally when we do a practice, almost any practice, really, We have these three parts where we start doing refuge and enlightenment thought. And then the middle part is the main practice, whatever we're going to do, whether it's mantra recitation or sutra reading or saying prayers or doing a sadhana, whatever the practice is that you're doing, that's sort of the main middle part. And then at the end we do the dedication, and that's pretty standard on most practices, right? In this case, though, refuge is the main practice, so it gets shifted into the middle. It's we already did the refuge prayer, so we've done the preliminary refuge prayer and bodhicitta enlightenment. But refuge, which is normally a preliminary, is now going to be moved to the middle as the main topic. So it's a kind of special situation now. And there's going to be five topics in here. First one being the cause. So who would like to read just this first paragraph here on the cause of taking refuge? Okay, nice and loud.
To begin, the three causes of seeking refuge are fear, faith, and compassion. Seeking refuge through fear means that being alarmed by the miseries of worldly existence experienced by others or oneself, one seeks refuge from them.
Okay. So fear, faith, and compassion. Now, one of these topics we've already talked about. Which one?
Faith.
We spent a whole chapter on faith, right? But fear and compassion we haven't touched on yet, so we're going to go through those now. So seeking refuge through fear means being alarmed by the miseries of worldly existence. When we say worldly existence, what are we referring to?
Samsara
is the word we usually use, which means cyclic existence of suffering, round and round, rebirth, right? So when they say worldly existence, that's what's being referred to. Experienced by others or oneself. We get alarmed by all this suffering that's just endless. It just goes around and around and around. Beginningless time, never ending, unless you get enlightened. And as His Holiness Dorje Chung Sakya Dakshin said to me one time, he said, it's meaningless. Just going around and around and around. If it had some meaning to it, if it got you somewhere, you could say, well, it's suffering, but at least I'm getting somewhere with it. But we're not going anywhere with it. We're just going like that. That's pretty scary. Also, we're in a really good rebirth right now, and some of the rebirths are really scary. So we're going to have a good dose of that in a few lessons. We're going to take a trip to the hell realms in various places and find out how scary it can be. But for now, just living it as a human, we've all been sick and suffered and had pain, you know. So we all know about that, and it's pretty scary just as it is to just think, well, I'm doing all this and it's not really getting me anywhere. I want my money back, you know. Okay, so fear is a motivating factor for taking refuge. Could you continue reading for us, please, Erin?
Sure.
This is, by this way, is Shanti Deva's quote.
Sure, I'll just start where I left off. As it was said in the...
Shanti Deva.
Formerly I disobeyed your words, but now, having seen great terror, in dismay I seek refuge in you. Quickly dispel my fears.
Okay, and you want to read the next line too?
Sure. One undertakes to rely upon this refuge, which completely saves oneself and all others who are afflicted by the sufferings of worldly existence.
So what does that mean? The Buddha has given us an out. He's given us a solution to this horrible, endless circle that we've been caught up in. And we've recognized that now. We've got faith. We've built faith. And we're building the other pillar of refuge. And not only does it save ourselves, but who else?
All others.
All other sentient beings, if we take the Mahayana Bodhisattva path, right? That's important to note. Okay. And here we have, again, this idea of worldly existence, meaning samsara. Now, so that's fear. And then faith, we've already studied, but so this is going to be a review now. Who would like to read the next paragraph for us here?
Okay, I will. Seeking refuge through faith means that in seeking refuge, one is motivated by any of the three kinds of faith. Faith of clear appreciation signifies that one discerns clearly the value of refuge, which has the ability to shield one from those fears of suffering. Faith of aspiration signifies that one wishes to attain the stage of refuge itself. And faith of confidence means that one trusts in the profound teaching of interdependent origination.
Okay, so this is kind of a review of what we've already studied and talked about. But there's one interesting thing to note here on the very last line where it says, faith of confidence means one trusts in the profound teaching of independent origination. Now, in the previous chapter, was that the only topic listed? Interdependent origination? Or were there some other topics?
Three jewels?
The four...
Noble truths, right.
Suffering cause, cessation path. There were a few topics listed, so I'm not sure why he just narrows it down to one here, but we already know that there's some other things too in this list. They just weren't listed here because you've studied and remembered the previous chapter perfectly. Okay, so that's faith. And then the third one, who would like to read the next paragraph for us? Linda, that was short. Why don't you keep reading?
Oh, okay. Okay. Seeking refuge through compassion refers to a person who has awakened into the Mahayana race. Being moved by the unbearable compassion for others who are afflicted by sufferings, which one infers from one's own sufferings, one seeks refuge in order to shelter them entirely.
Okay, now, even though this is only two sentences, there's quite a bit in here. So let's see what we can understand from this. So first of all, when the author says compassion, we need to understand, well, what does that word mean? Okay, a lot of times when people use that word just normally would say, has this idea of empathy. Oh, there's some poor person or some poor animal suffering. Oh, I really feel for that, right? But in Buddhism, there's a little bit more to the meaning. And not just in Buddhism. Actually, I went and I looked it up in the Merriam-Webster Dictionary, and it said, sympathetic consciousness of others' distress together with a desire to alleviate it. So that second piece, it's not just empathy, but hey, I want to see if I can do something here, you know, to fix this situation. So we really have the desire and, if possible, the action to alleviate the suffering. So when we talk about compassion in this context, we're talking about both of those things. Okay. And then it says it refers to a person who has awakened into the Mahayana race. What does that mean?
The great vehicle?
Evil?
Vehicle.
Okay. Anybody want to elaborate a little more? What does the race part of it, though? What does race have to do with it?
Well, which kind of race?
Yeah. What does that mean?
Is it like a group of people?
A race is a group of people who are
going
in the same direction, and they have some kind of
connection
or relationship, right? Isn't that normally what race means?
Like,
yeah. So what does that mean, though, the Mahayana race?
The Bodhisattva race.
Yeah, the Bodhisattva race is the Mahayana means great vehicle.
Yeah.
And we talked about Bodhisattva being the hero that's committed to attaining enlightenment for the sake of all beings. But still, why were we saying race? Isn't that kind of an odd term to use here?
I don't know. I've never heard it used in this context.
Yeah.
Well, Lama can correct me if I'm wrong, but this is what I understand to be. Now, some of us have taken the Bodhisattva vow, sometimes more than once. And sometimes when the master gives the vow, they talk about that you are now completely changed. You now have a new name. You can change your name to Child of the Buddha. So it's like entering into a family when you take the Bodhisattva vow. You actually, it's a major step. You really actually change your identity. And so, or you could say Buddha's heirs, H-E-I-R-S, if you prefer. So there is actually a familial connection to the Buddhas when you take the, you're in their lineage, really, is what it means. Lama's not saying no, so I'll take that as a yes.
We've
okay.
made a serious commitment. Right?
Yeah, it's a very serious commitment. Yeah, enlightenment for the sake of all beings. I'm going to keep practicing until then. Could be long trip, could be a short trip, but however long it takes.
No matter how many
lives. Yeah, long, yeah. Right? So that's this idea of I've completely changed my identity, but with this commitment of a spiritual path of the Bodhisattva. At least that's the way I understand it. And then it says, being moved by unbearable compassion for others who are afflicted by sufferings, which one infers from one's own sufferings. What does that mean?
Broken heart.
Broken
we're
heart?
Together. We're
sorry?
We're all in it together.
We're all in it together.
We're all the same.
Sorry?
We're all the same.
We're all the same, yeah. I'm suffering, but so are you, and you look around, it's pretty easy to see. It's pretty easy to see other people suffering, and you know you have your own suffering. So this, I think, also refers to a specific practice that can be done, which is equalizing self and others, which is a practice, if you're not familiar with, you can learn from a teacher. And it's for the development of this whole idea of bodhisattva and doing it for others. The first step is just recognizing that, oh yeah, I'm suffering and I'm usually caught up in my own problems, but mm-hmm. if I look around, looks like everybody's got their own problems, might not be the same as mine. And so this is a step in our spiritual development towards exchanging self for others, which is another further step, which we won't go into now. We're moved by unbearable compassion. I mean, if you really look and you really have empathy and compassion, it just becomes like, oh my goodness. Plus, if samsara is beginningless and sentient beings are infinite, at some point everybody's been who?
Your mother.
Our mother.
Our father.
Our father. Our great uncle or somebody. But somebody who's helped us and raised us and given us life, literally, and more, it would be not very good to just say, well, I'm okay, too bad you're suffering. So we're moved by our compassion, right? Just seeing other people and repaying the gratitude, repaying the debt, really. It's a karmic debt we owe, really, literally, all sentient beings. So anyway, this is a meditative process that we go through in our spiritual development. How am I going to help these suffering beings? I mean, we might even try, but sometimes when we try, we actually make things worse. We really don't have much power when it comes to removing other people's suffering. But who does have the power?
Enlightened beings.
Yeah, the Buddhas, right? They have the power. So that's why we're focused on enlightenment for the sake of all beings. And to do that, what's the first step in getting enlightened?
Taking refuge.
Refuge is the first step, right? Before you take refuge, you're not really a Buddhist. taking refuge is that it's a formalized, it's really a refuge ceremony. It's a ceremony. It's formalized. It's a step you do. You go on to the path when you take refuge. So that's why it says one seeks refuge in order to shelter them entirely. So we're not able to now, but if we become enlightened, we will be able to help, just like the Buddha helping us by teaching us and showing us. So we take refuge in order to get going in that direction, get our spiritual engine revved up. Can somebody volunteer to read the next paragraph for us, please?
I'll volunteer. In brief, it is most important to seek refuge with a clear recollection of the causes just described. For the action of taking refuge without reflection does not achieve any merit.
Yeah. Maybe go ahead and read what Shantideva has to say about that, if you would.
The Omniscient One has taught that though they be practiced for a long time, all repetitions of austerities and mantras are useless if the mind be distracted elsewhere.
Okay, so that's pretty clear that if we're doing any kind of practice, whatever it is, whether it's mantras or whatever practice we're doing, if you're thinking about what kind of pizza you're going to order afterwards, you might get a good pizza, but you won't get any merit. It doesn't count. And there are stories of great practitioners who did huge amounts of practice. Sometimes at certain points they realized that their mind had wandered and they were doing practices that were counted, you know. That's why we have malas and things to count. And when they realized their mind was distracted, they went back and they didn't count those. They erased those numbers. They don't count if you're not focused on it. If you're not mindful of your practice, sorry. And Shantideva, he's going to drive this home a few times in the text. We're going to hear this again and again. Why? Because we all have to deal with that. Unless you're already enlightened. But if you are, we don't know. So we'll assume that we all have to deal with it because we all have this thing called monkey mind that wanders and thinks about pizza and other things, you know. So it's really important that we are honest with ourselves because you can't fudge it. The Lord of Karma doesn't buy it. So Shantideva is going to remind us of that. So all of that is part A, which is the cause of taking refuge. And now we're going to go to B, the object of taking refuge. Who wants to read now?
I'll go again.
Okay.
There are many different views concerning the object of refuge. Due to both variance between the Mahayana and the Hinayana traditions, and to variations within Mahayana and Hinayana themselves. Here the object, the place of refuge, is the master and his lineage of preceptors who have revealed to one the transcendentally exalted path. The jewel of the Enlightened One, the Buddha, is the one who has accomplished the body of reality, Dharmakaya, which is the most excellent condition for one's own self, and which is endowed with every kind of virtue and free from every kind of imperfection. Further, the Enlightened One attained the form body, Rupakaya, which accomplishes the excellent condition in order to benefit others, and which acts solely for the welfare of beings for as long as worldly existence lasts. The jewel of teaching, the Dharma, is the precepts, which consists of 1. The doctrine and of the 3 collections of scripture, or the 12 categories of the Enlightened One's speech, and 2. The realization, which consists of the 3 trainings, or the 2 aspects of cessation and the path. The jewel of assembly, the Sangha, comprises the noble ones who dwell on the stages of irreversibility, and those ordinary beings who have entered the doctrine prior to oneself.
Okay, so there's quite a bit here. Let's see if we can make our way through this. Thank you for reading that passage. Okay, so the very first thing that The very first line says there's many different views, and I think that needs to be emphasized, that there are many different ways of looking at this, talking about it, practicing it, and they're all good. The Buddha taught a lot of different ways of practicing. Why?
Because they're all different.
There's a lot of different kinds of beings, and not everybody's the same, so he knew that. So there's a lot of different ways, and we shouldn't denigrate other people's views or other people's way of doing it, because if the Buddha taught it, that's the Buddha's teaching. So it's really important, I think, to remember that. We want to avoid any kind of sectarianism or my way is better than your way and that kind of stuff, which happens sometimes. We want to make sure we avoid that. And then it's explained, you know, that the reason is there's variation between Mahayana and Hinayana. Now, Hinayana is a word that's kind of starting to fall out of favor a little bit, because some people think it has a kind of a... It could be interpreted kind of negatively. It literally means lesser vehicle, but it's kind of, we're kind of finding other words. I like the word foundation path. Some people use the word fundamental path. I don't know. Does anybody have another favorite alternative?
Shravakayana.
Yeah. So it's still a valid path, okay, whatever you want to call it. And also, the ways that different paths do refuge is a little bit different, so we need to respect that. But here, what kind of text is this? What lineage are we here in this text?
Sakya.
Sakya, but is it Hinayana or Mahayana?
Mahayana.
It's Mahayana, which means great vehicle, right? So this particular passage is going to be presented from that point of view. We're not going to do the whole gamut of everybody else's way of doing it. That would take a long time. So just keep in mind that there's all these different ways, but here we're going to learn this Mahayana way, okay? So, and even within Mahayana, there's different ways of doing it. And it says so here, right? In this case, sometimes there's three objects of refuge. Sometimes there's four objects of refuge. Here, we're going to see four, okay? So just so you know, just to give you a little map of where we're going here. Here, the object, the place of refuge, is the master and his lineage of preceptors who have revealed to one the transcendental exalted path. What does that mean? Who's the master? Buddha is the master and... But we missed the Buddha. That was 2,600 years ago.
So it would be our teacher.
Right? Yeah, our teacher, your guru, your root guru, the person that you have your lineage from, and the preceptor. So in this particular case, we're talking about Lamdre. We would talk about Buddha, Virupa, the Sakya masters, and so on, until whoever, you know, whoever we had contact with. And they have revealed to one the transcendental exalted path. Wow, that sounds nice, but what is it?
That liberation?
Is it?
Or the path to liberation?
Is it? Is it?
Is it this path? The transcendental exalted path, the three visions?
Yeah, the three visions are... You could say that it might also, in some cases, be the Vajrayana path, but it's not liberation. Remember we talked the first night about liberation not being synonymous with complete, perfect enlightenment?
Right.
So the Shravakayana path leads to liberation, right, Stephen? But the Mahayana path leads to
enlightenment.
Complete and perfect enlightenment. So that's a distinction to know. And so the transcendentally exalted path, I would assume here means some sort of Mahayana practice. It might be Lamdre, but it might be another practice, but it's not what we would call the foundation path. Is that clear as mud? Yeah, okay. I didn't say that very clearly, but hopefully you got the idea. That's the first refuge, is the guru. Okay? And then the second one, the jewel of the enlightened one, the Buddha, is the one who has accomplished the body of reality, the Dharmakaya, which is the most excellent conditions for one's own self, and which is endowed with every kind of virtue and free from every kind of imperfection. Woo! Wow. Okay. So, the Buddha is the second refuge. It's not only the historical Buddha, but all Buddhas, right? They're all the same, really. And why? Well, Buddha is the one who has accomplished the body of reality, the Dharmakaya. Now, body of reality is the English translation of Dharmakaya. Sometimes it's called the truth body. Sometimes it's called the wisdom body. Any other translations floating around that people know? You'll see it written different ways. Which is the most excellent condition for one's own self. What does that mean?
Well, that's what you attain to or aspire to.
Yeah. So when you become enlightened, you attain this body. Now, sometimes it's said the Buddha has two bodies. Sometimes it's said the Buddha has three bodies. Sometimes the Buddha has four bodies. In this case, two bodies. One being the body of reality or the Dharmakara, which is impossible to describe because it's beyond words, beyond concepts, beyond duality. It's until you get there, really, you don't really fully know, except that it's the state of existence of Buddhas. It's the highest state of existence to attain, I guess you could say. But any description that you make of it is limited because we're using words, and words are limited, and Dharmakaya is not limited in any way whatsoever.
Isn't Dharmakaya experience?
Yeah, so when you get there, you'll know, right?
Yeah.
Okay. So the Buddha has accomplished that, and it's perfectly blissful and happy, you know, but we've already said that a bodhisattva, and Buddhas come from bodhisattvas, isn't just doing it for himself or herself, but for
all
sentient beings. The Buddha, who's got perfect compassion, wouldn't just sit there and go, well, too bad you guys didn't make it, I made it. What would the Buddha do?
Lead others to make it too.
Come back.
Yeah, do something to help them. Do whatever was appropriate. Mm. And because they're omniscient, they know what's appropriate. They're not like us, who we try to help and sometimes make it worse. They always know exactly what that person needs and that person needs and that person needs, that being needs. And they spontaneously act out of compassion, great compassion. So how do they do that? Because they're in the Dharmakaya, there's no form, there's no description. What do?
They can manifest.
They manifest another body. And in this case, it's called the form body or the Rupakaya. What does that mean? What kind of form?
Any form that's needed.
Any form that's needed. Might be a human being.
Dog.
Might be what?
A dog.
An animal.
A bridge.
An inanimate object. Mm-hmm. Whatever's needed. Because they know exactly. And they're spontaneous and they respond out of compassion. So the Rupakaya is just kind of a general name for any form manifestation that the Buddha takes in order to act compassionately to relieve suffering. Cool, huh? And it says right here, which accomplishes the excellent condition in order to benefit others, and which acts solely for the welfare of beings for as long as worldly existence lasts. So there's no end to the Buddha's compassion. When there's a need, when some being is in suffering and some sorrow, they will act. That's what we aspire to. And that's what we go to refuge to when we say Buddha. So Guru, Buddha, who's next? The jewel teaching, the Dharma, is the precepts which consists of the doctrine of the three collections of scripture or the 12 categories of the enlightened one's speech and the realization which consists of the three trainings or the two aspects of sensation and the path. So that's another long sentence. So the third object of refuge is the Dharma, which needs to be explained. Now we have talked about this a little bit beforehand. It's the precepts. So what are the precepts? Well, it consists of the doctrines of the three collections of scripture. You remember we talked about the three collections of scripture before? What's the other word we use?
Baskets.
Three baskets. Remember we talked about the three baskets? Anybody remember what's in the three baskets?
Vinaya.
Vinaya?
The Abhidharma.
Uh-huh. What's in the middle? Sutras. Yeah. Okay, so that's the collections, the baskets of scripture. The 12 categories just refers to the different types of speech that the Buddha uses, like prose, poetry, stories, biographies, previous life stories, stuff like that. There's these different categories of Buddha speech. So that's the first one. The three collections are the 12 categories. So we have basically what we would call the teachings. Yeah. But there's another part. When we say Dharma, there's another part, which is the realization, the practice, and the realization that comes from the practice. Going back to the medicine on the shelf, it's not enough. You've got to take the medicine. So you do the practice and you get the realizations, which consists of the three trainings. So what are the three trainings? Does anybody remember that? If you have the three baskets, that's the teaching, but when you practice, what do you get? What are the actual trainings themselves?
Morality.
Moral conduct is the first
mind
one.
Mind training.
Sorry?
Mind training.
Yeah, mind training or meditative concentration. Mm-hmm. And?
Phenomenological psychology.
What's a simple word for us normal people, Stephen?
Insight.
Yeah, insight or wisdom, right? Yeah. Stephen doesn't mind me joking with him, do you, Stephen? Okay, so that's the actual, it's kind of you take the three baskets and you practice them, that's what you do, right? So the Dharma has these two aspects of it, it's the teaching and then the realizations that come from the practice. Right? Okay? Or, two aspects of cessation and path, which are two of the four.
Cessation.
Four Noble Truths. Suffering, cause, sensation, path, right? Buddhism 101. Okay, so there's different ways of talking about it, but that's what it is when we say Dharma. Dharma has lots and lots of meanings also, but when we're talking about refuge, that's what we mean. And then the fourth object is what? The Sangha, which is the noble ones who dwell on the stages of irreversibility and those ordinary beings who have entered the doctrine prior to oneself. What does that mean?
That they started the path on a previous life?
Previous life or even this life. So that's the second one.
Like you've taken the vows.
Hmm?
Taken the vows.
What vows?
Those who have taken the vows and entered the path.
Before you.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And what about these noble ones on the stages of irreversibility? What's that about?
The Supreme Assembly.
What does that mean, though? Who are they?
All the other Buddhas and Bodhisattvas.
It's usually the Bodhisattvas, yeah. The path, if you ever have the good fortune of studying Sakyapandita's Clarifying the Sage's Intent, it's a roadmap, basically, of the path. It's an awesome text. I love it. From before being a Buddhist to taking refuge, getting on the path, and then going through the whole path, it's a roadmap. If you want to drive from here to Toronto, you know, you need a GPS. On this very advanced when you get very advanced on the path, there are what are called grounds or bhumis or stages of very advanced bodhisattvas. And usually when we talk about noble ones or exalted ones, that's who we're referring to. I mean, they're... And if you read Sage's Intent, the descriptions are pretty amazing. Really amazing. So we have, when we say Sangha, we have kind of like two categories. We have the A team and the B team. We have the bodhisattvas on the grounds, the higher grounds, and irreversibility. At a certain point, you cannot fall back into the lower realms.
Is that 10th ground or 9th or 10th?
You know, I've heard different teachings about the number, and I don't want to say.
But it's up there in those higher...
And Lama's not saying, so maybe some other time we'll determine. I've heard 7, I've heard 9, I've heard... But yeah. Anyway, at a certain point, when I get there, I'll tell you, you don't go back. Like, we could still fall back into lower rebirths.
Yeah.
Fairly easily, actually. But at a certain point, it's not even possible. Of course, you wouldn't anyway, but it's called irreversibility, the stages of irreversibility, somewhere up on the bhumis.
Because they have developed their practice and their ability that far.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So when we talk about the Sangha or the jewel of assembly, it says here, which is kind of a nice term, isn't it?
Yeah.
The jewel of assembly. When we go for refuge, that's what we're referring to, these two types. And then, as we said the other day, in common usage when we talk about Sangha, it's fairly common to just talk about, you know, us. We're the Sangha, so you'll hear that usage too. But here we're talking about going for refuge. So we'll make a distinction here. We're kind of moving along here. Do we have questions or... Should we keep going? It's 8 o'clock. Can we do a little more?
When they talk about the object of taking refuge, does that imply that someone would take one of those objects, or they would take all of them?
All of them.
So it's the objects of taking refuge.
Yeah, yeah. You'll hear the term triple gem, triple jewel, but in this case, it's four. It's like the Three Musketeers are actually four. You know that? And again, there's different ways of talking about and practicing these refuges. And there's very extensive teachings about how long you take it for and so on and so forth. So this is pretty compact. And again, as we've said lots of times, you can't put everything in this book, and there's plenty to study and learn outside of this. But this is a good summary, I think. And the next section is pretty long. Let's give it a shot. What do you say?
Sure.
So C, the procedure for taking refuge. So, okay, I'm sold. How do I do it? How do we actually do it? Now, before we read this, I just want to point out something that actually Precious Lama Jampa pointed out when he gave this commentary, which is, in the book it talks about sitting on a cushion and do this and do that, but Lama pointed out that you can do it in other ways, like for example when you're doing prostrations. You can take refuge, do prostrations simultaneously. It's like a double, it's like two for one day at Costco or something, you know, you get double your merit if you combine two practices. And there's a lot of different ways of doing prostrations, and that's a whole nother discussion. But just so that you know, as we read this, and the author talks about sitting on cushions and stuff, it could also be done in other ways too. Okay. This is a long paragraph. Who feels like their voice is strong enough to read this? Nicole, please.
Okay. Having prostrated, worshipped, and made offerings before the preceptors in image of the three jewels as described above, be seated on a comfortable cushion in the meditative posture. Visualize that one's preceptors, the Buddhas, and their spiritual sons, the Bodhisattvas, are all actually present and seated in the space in front of oneself. Next, imagine that oneself, one's friends, all living beings in the six realms of existence ranging throughout space are assembled in front of the Holy Ones. These beings all experience their devotion by bodily clasping their palms, by vocally reciting the formula of refuge, and by mentally arousing intense faith and devotion. Consider the significance of this act of taking refuge by thinking, throughout a multitude of former lifetimes, I did not act in accordance with the words of spiritual friends. By not holding... Sorry, I just need to take a breath. But by not holding to the three jewels as my refuge, I had become terribly distressed by many sufferings in worldly existence. Now, indeed, no matter what befalls me, whether good or evil, I shall rely upon the compassion of my preceptors and the three jewels as my guide until I have attained enlightenment. Confidently trusting in the three jewels and earnestly wishing for their help.
Thank you. Well read. So having prostrated, worshipped, and made offerings before the preceptors in the image of the three jewels as described above, that's kind of like a preliminary practice that could be done before you actually sit down on a comfortable cushion in a meditative posture. And then there's a description of visualization. Now, some people are naturally visually oriented, and visualization comes easy to them. My sister's like that. She's an artist. She sees stuff that I don't see. And in fact, when I first started practicing, I couldn't visualize anything at all. I mean, zero, nada, niente, goose egg, the big nothing burger. And it's kind of distressing because there's all these practices that say, well, visualize this and visualize that. And I'm going, yeah, but I don't see anything. So, of course, I went to Geshe-la and said, Geshe-la, I don't see anything. And he would say, continue. Okay, so every day, you know, and then nothing. And then I would go back to Geshe-la and say, but I'm still not seeing anything. And he would say, continue. And this went on every day for 16 years. That's a long time to see nothing.
Yeah.
But that's what he said to do, so that's what I did. And then one day, guess what happened?
You saw something.
I saw something. Oh, yeah. I could visualize. Now, I'm not super perfect or anything, but you don't have to be. So I'm saying this for all those people that are saying, yeah, but I don't visualize. Don't worry. Just continue. Okay. So, but if you can visualize, there's a description here. You visualize, okay, the preceptors, the Buddhas, and their spiritual sons. Now, this translation was issued in 1985, and that means it was worked on before 1985, and a lot of years have passed since then. So if you would like to substitute children for sons, or heirs, H-E-I-R-S, for sons.
Or daughters. No.
Well, sons and daughters and everybody else, or whatever. Feel free to make it work for you, but I'm just, not to criticize the translator, believe me, but just feel free to change that. So you have the Buddhas, and also this relates to what we just talked about, the race, the children, right? So you visualize that. The Bodhisattvas, and you visualize that they're actually present and seated in a space in front of you. And so, do we have a refuge tree here?
Right behind you, close to Sakyapandita.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. So that tanka there, which maybe you can look at afterwards if you want to, that's an elaborate visualization. It's called the refuge tree, I think, usually. It's kind of elaborate, and don't feel like you have to start with that, but do whatever you can and visualize whatever you can in front of you, right? We're going for refuge here. Next, imagine that oneself, one's friends, and all living beings in the six realms of existence, ranging throughout space, are assembled in front of the Holy Ones. Now again, there's different ways you can do this, and different teachers will describe different ways of doing it. But, for example, sometimes they say, well, your father's on your right, your mother's on your left, the males are on the right, the females are on the left, your enemies are in front, or it's just a big group. There's all different kinds of ways of doing it. Your relatives and all sentient beings, really, if you can manage it, because we're doing this for all sentient beings. And then His Holiness, the Sakatrichan, has said, and I've heard him say this more than once, he's such an amazing teacher. He says, well, you know, if you're going to go to all that trouble, you might as well multiply yourself into a whole bunch of infinite visualizations, and then you get a whole bunch of merit. If you're going to go do all that work, why not get a whole lot of merit out of it? I said, okay, that sounds... So if you can manage it, you can visualize a lot of yous, yourselves, there too, because it's the practice is a mental practice. I mean, Buddhism basically is mind training, right? So do whatever you're comfortable with, and don't feel like you have to, you know, get too crazy with it, but whatever you're comfortable with, you visualize this, and then you visualize everybody's clasping their palms, reciting the formula of refuge, and mentally arousing intense faith and devotion. Faith and devotion, there it is again. We keep talking about those two things. And then consider the significance of this act of taking refuge by thinking, throughout a multitude of former lifetimes, I did not act in accordance with the words of spiritual friends. And by not holding to the three jewels as my refuge, I had become terribly distressed by many sufferings in worldly existence.
I'm sorry.
Geshe-la used to say sometimes, he had a knack for really... Well, Buddha was 2,600 years ago. How come you're not enlightened yet? What have you been doing all this time? How many lifetimes have you had? You know. Well, I've been doing this. I haven't been going for refuge, and I haven't been practicing, and I haven't followed this. And this is where I've ended up. Still stuck in the meaningless circle of samsara. So, now, though, I've smartened up. And indeed, no matter what befalls me, good or evil, I shall rely upon the compassion of my preceptors and the three jewels as my guide until I have attained enlightenment, confidently trusting in the three jewels and earnestly wishing for their help. So I'm going to make a change. I've joined the Buddha's race. What I've done so far hasn't worked very well, and I'm going to change my path, and refuge is the first step. And I'm going to make a resolution right now in this manner. So that's the way you should think about it. Yeah? Let's read the next paragraph. Aaron, do you want to read that for us?
Sure. Starting with holding
on. Yeah.
Hold the mind in single-pointed devotion to one's preceptors and the Enlightened One as the illuminators who will show one the path of total liberation. To the teaching as the actual path itself, and to the assembly as one's helpers who assist one in completing that path. Then pray, may the preceptors and the three jewels see to it that all actions of body, speech, and mind of all beings and myself be directed along the path of enlightenment.
Yeah, so we're asking for help and we're relying on help. You don't have to do this alone. In fact, you can't, really. I mean, we've been doing it alone until now, and look where it's gotten us, not very far. But we have enough merit to be in this room tonight reading this text. And so we don't want to waste that opportunity because it's a precious human rebirth. We're going to talk about that later some more, but we have this incredible opportunity now. The opportunity, though, is like that. Shanti Deva says it's like a flash of lightning in the night. It illuminates, but it's gone. And if you miss it... So we want to make sure that we get it. And this ceremony and this process, this practice of refuge, we're now saying, you know, please help me. I want to do it right this time, okay? So that's the prayer. Not only for me, but all sentient beings. And just as oneself takes refuge, visualize that all beings throughout space are taking refuge in the same way. We talked about that, this multiple visualization you can do, and perform the fourfold refuge many times with heartfelt sincerity. And then finally prostrate and go for refuge to the preceptors and three precious jewels and request their blessing. So why many times, though? I mean, isn't once enough? I mean, come on.
At least in the morning and in the evening.
Yeah, but why?
Is it to keep your focus, and because there's so many distractions in life?
That's a good reason, isn't it?
Yeah.
Any other reasons?
Many times. So it gets instilled in your being, your consciousness.
That's another good reason. Any other reasons?
To arouse the help of the higher beings, for want of a better word.
Yeah.
Is it to establish sincerity, too?
Okay. Lots of reasons.
Yeah.
There's one more. Sometimes, like when you do laundry, usually the traditional format is you have the teaching in the morning, and then in the afternoon you have a sort of review / practice. And I remember in the afternoon sessions doing the refuge 21 times.
Oh my God.
Yeah. Why? I mean, isn't that a... Don't you think that's a waste of time, Nicole?
I don't know. I mean, it seems like too much.
It's a lot. Try it. Go home tonight or tomorrow and read this 21 times. But why would a teacher or master lead a group
in some traditions, and even in the Sakya tradition, you'll do refuge 100,000 times.
Well, now wait a minute.
Before moving.
Wait a minute. That's a lot.
Wait. Okay, I know why. Is it because it's the first step? Like, it's the most important step? And so you want to have that foundation really solid to move forward?
Yes.
Yeah, but it's not,
yes.
It's not the only practice that is repeated many thousands of times.
Is it to memorize them? Like, the only reason I would repeat something is to memorize it.
Well, if you do it 100,000 times, you probably have it memorized
yeah,
by then.
I mean.
But why do we do so many? Why? I mean, even 21. Never mind 100,000, which is...
Just gain merit.
5 points for merit. It's a merit-generating activity which is unlimited. It's, I would say, infinite merit. And why do we need merit?
So that we can progress along the path.
Yeah, we have to do the two...
The two accumulations
of...
Merit.
And transcendental wisdom. And wisdom depends upon... Merit. So merit is fundamental. We have to do meritorious. Meritorious means positive spiritual energy.
And merit, isn't that synonymous with compassion? Merit and with compassion and wisdom, merit and wisdom?
Yeah, in some contexts, Stephen?
Merit is synonymous with virtue. Virtue is synonymous with power.
Okay.
Merit, could you say that's like effort?
There is certainly effort involved in the practicing of it. That's one of the six perfections that we haven't gotten into yet. But yes, effort plays into it for sure. I mean, if you're going to do anything, even 21 times, it takes a little bit of effort.
Doesn't it create good karma?
Of course.
Yeah.
Of course.
Yeah.
Of course.
Because merit sounds kind of like a little bit abstract to me. I think effort, thinking about merit as effort, helps me kind of bridge the gap. Okay,
if you want to look at it that way, yeah.
Well, merit's more than effort. It's kind of more, it's like attaining, like a ribbon, you know, or sort of...
It's like the reward for
the
effort.
Reward, yeah. Accumulating an ability.
Yeah, it's accumulation of positive energy.
Maybe that's why it's just
negative energies for so long.
You better believe it.
Samsara.
Yeah, we've all done everything and been everything. So
yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay, so besides all these good reasons that have been listed, the the main reason I would say is that it's a merit accumulating practice, and it's beyond measure. I mean, some things are good, but some things are more good. So refuge is one of these practices which is really good, and so we repeat it. So this idea that, well, I'm just going to go for refuge once, no. In fact, every single practice, well, what's the first thing we do? We go for refuge. And that's the reason. And that accumulation of merit supports your practice. So sometimes people say, well, I did all these practices and I didn't get any result. Yeah, because you didn't have enough merit. Go do a meritorious practice and you'll build up your energy.
And you may not know that you didn't get a result, because
yeah.
It might come later.
Yeah, right? Like especially if you do more merit.
And it takes time, just like anything.
Yeah.
It's not like taking a pill and suddenly you have a little trip, you know.
Yeah.
It's supposed to be joyful effort, and that's important. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, the six professions, of which effort is one of them, is a big topic, and we're really not into it now, but I actually personally don't like the term effort, because it sounds like work. I like joyous enthusiasm.
Yeah.
Yeah, where you're actually getting joy out of it. Actually, the perfection of joyous enthusiasm means you take joy in accumulating merit. That's what it means. So you're not doing it, oh, well, I have to do it. No, it's like, I want to do it, and I'm getting, this is good. This is really good. So a joyous enthusiasm is my personal preference for the translation. Sometimes you hear diligence, which also sounds kind of like work. But you'll see these different translations. But that's...
Yes. It is work.
It is work, but is we want to have some joy, because I got enough struggle in my life as it is, right?
It is work, but what is work? It's an activity, so a joyous activity.
Yeah, yeah. Anyway, that's sort of a tangent. You know, the six perfections is another lesson sometime. Okay, so I would say that this would be a good place to just call it an evening. And we still obviously haven't finished Refuge, which, as you can see, goes on for a few more pages. Are there any final comments or...
Okay, so what page did we finish on? Page 12?
Page 12, right at the top, just that very... Yeah, that's the last paragraph that we've done for tonight. Okay, so to be continued. Any final comments or questions or complaints? Okay, so guess what we're going to do now? The Umze will lead us in dedication, prayer. Dedicate the merit, exactly. And we'll talk about dedication too, but for now we'll just do it.
Sure.
May all attain omniscience. May it defeat the enemy wrongdoing from the stormy waves of birth, old age, sickness, and death. From the ocean of samsara, may all beings be free. Bodhicitta is precious. May it arise in all beings in whom it has not arisen, in every divine where it has arisen. May it never grow and flourish. In whatever way valiant Manjushri and Samantabhadra know how to transfer merit, so do I dedicate all of my own virtues that I may train to be like them. This dedication, produced as supreme by the victorious Buddhas of the past, present, and future, I, together with all sentient beings, dedicate these roots of virtue to attain Buddhahood. May whatever gain from prostrating, offering, confessing, rejoicing, requesting, and beseeching be dedicated to attaining perfect enlightenment.
Thank you, Michael.
Thank you. So, Aaron, what's the homework?
Contemplation and meditation.
Read over and contemplate.
If you want. If you want. Or if you don't want, just check your cups.